Blog Talk Radio.
And hello out there to all you Brooklyn folk. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Bedford and Sullivan Podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners in the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series research process. And that's the most rehearsed part of the show that I'm going to have today. We are very, very happy to get back on the air with the New York Giants Preservation Society's Gary Mintz. We of course, are a Brooklyn-focused podcast, but we can't do it without the rivals from Upper Manhattan. And without further ado, let me welcome Gary to the program. Gary, it's been a while, but thank you for joining us today.
Sam, always a pleasure. And despite the giant Dodger rivalry, there is no animosity here at all.
And same here. And I figured, you know, we have a lot to discuss in terms of the history of, you know, there's really never-ending conversation when it comes to everything that has happened prior to us. But unfortunately, we're going to start with some sadness here. One of the fellow guests from the podcast, Peter McGowan, the former owner of the San Francisco Giants, who also grew up in Upper Manhattan as a Giants fan, he has unfortunately passed, and I thought we'd lead with your memories of Peter McGowan.
My memories of Peter McGowan, first of all, one of the nicest gentlemen I've ever had to deal with. He was just a wonderful human being, never wasn't a stuffed shirt. He was a down-to-earth guy. He loved talking baseball with us. The first time I met him, actually, I was at Shea Stadium with my friend Steve. And, you know, most of the fans go up to the guys in the uniforms, but we noticed Peter McGowan was behind the dugout, and then he, I guess, was heading up the aisle, and we tracked him down and spoke to him. He was such a nice guy. Then we got to know him through the Giants. He, of course, was the biggest supporter of the franchise, being that he grew up as a New York Giant fan, and when his family moved to San Francisco, it was the same year as the Giants moved to San Francisco. So for him, he was very fortunate. His childhood team was now his adult team. And he, of course, saved the Giants from moving from San Francisco in the early 90s. Decorated the ballpark with much memorabilia from the New York days, from the, you know, retired numbers to the flags that wave up on top of the stadium. He was involved in the formation of the Gotham Club, or if he wasn't directly involved, it was something that he much admired. He was just a wonderful guy, and he spoke to our group at Bergino's baseball clubhouse, you know, for a good 2 hours that day. It was an overflow crowd, and his love for baseball and the Giants especially is sorely missed. I tried to contact him at his home, and they said he was in San Francisco, and then the next day, you know, he had passed away. Sorely missed. He's going to have a plaque put on the San Francisco Wall of Fame at what is now Oracle Park later this year. It was supposed to be earlier, but, you know, he did pass away. But just a tremendous guy. And one last thing I'd like to add. We had AT&T Park out in San Francisco a night to honor the Polo Grounds, and he spoke to the crowd with about five of us on the field with him. And at the end, all I remember was the Giant officials asking me to, you know, follow them off the field. And Peter McGowan was like, no, follow me. And I was at the crossroads. What do I do? And I was like, you know, he was the big kahuna with the Giants. What's going to happen to me? So I followed him, took us through the dugout, and we went to the Giant clubhouse, and Willie Mays was there waiting for us. So my only regret for Peter McGowan was that by the time they won in 10, 12, and 14, he was not the main guy in charge, and he really deserved to be because he's just a wonderful man.
Well, considering, like you said, he was a big proponent in keeping the Giants in San Francisco, and it's just funny the way that all comes back around after, you know, one city loses them, you know, another one, they become so endearing to that city that you can't even imagine them leaving San Francisco. I mean, I can't imagine saying the Tampa Bay Giants, but that's what we would have if it hadn't been for Peter McGowan.
That is absolutely correct. And, you know, me being somebody on the East Coast, that might have been better for my viewing habits. That being said, very unfair to the people in San Francisco who now have reaped the rewards. I mean, things aren't that great now, but they have certainly benefited from what's gone on in the last 10 years.
Well, as they say, there can only be darkness with light. So it's a give and take, c'est la vie, such as life, and we hope that Peter McGowan is resting easy out there. And
and he's sorely missed.
Absolutely,
and
unfortunately, we've all lost some other members of the Giants family over the last year.
Yeah, you know, a couple of years back, we lost Monty Irvin, who was a tremendous human being. Of course, he was one of the first African Americans in baseball to follow Jackie Robinson. Just the tremendous.
And sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to mention also that I believe I drive his hometown. If I'm correct, Monty Irvin grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. I'm a Lyft driver
I think he's in Orange.
Orange. I'm going to look that up right now. I think Larry Doby, who was the first American League African-American player, I believe grew up in Paterson. And you are completely correct as I confirm what you just said, because I do believe looking that up very recently. But, yeah, I've been driving, for all those of you who don't know, I drive a Lyft car, which is a rideshare car, the competition of Uber, who have kind of become the band-aid of rideshare, if you will. And Monty Irvin, I see both Larry Doby and Monty Irvin memorials in their hometowns of Paterson and Orange, respectively. But a little bit of connection.
Yeah, I believe both of them are from, I think they're, both of those towns are in Essex County. That's probably why, because a few years back,
right,
they made plaques for Yogi Berra, Larry Doby, and Monty Irvin, they're all from the same area in Jersey.
And Monty Irvin, it looks like, went to East Orange High School. He was born in Hallaburg, Alabama, on February 25th, 1919, and died January 11th, 2016.
You know, Sam,
which
on
another,
his birthday,
yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, on his birthday, we had a meeting at our new home, Finnerty's, on February 25th to honor his 100th birthday. We had a couple of speakers from the group.
Oh, wow.
His daughter sent us a letter that, you know, I read out loud, and it was a nice way to honor his 100th birthday. Would be 100th birthday.
In 1951, of course, in 1951, he hit 24 home runs and 121 RBIs, and yet that was still only good enough to be third in the MVP race. And Roy Campanella took that one home with 11 first-place votes. He got 5 first-place votes that year behind Stan Musial and Roy Campanella. And you know, you really can't bark at those other two names, but I'm going back to it right now. Looks like he was an all-star in 1952, finished 15th in MVP voting in 1953. He's a Hall of Fame career, no doubt.
Yeah, you know, what's mostly said about him is, you know, he just came up a little too late. He would have started a little, you know, if baseball had been integrated, you would have seen him more in his prime. But
30,
really,
he was 30 in 1949 when he came up.
And think about the players today, you know, they're coming up when they're 21 and 22. You know, so even if he would have came up at 24, he would have had 6 years in the big leagues. And if you're probably looking at his 6 years in the Negro Leagues, I'm sure, you know, the numbers speak for themselves.
Well, I'm actually going to check that, too, because my guess is – yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say our group was invited to attend his memorial in Orange, which was, you know, a very big thing there. They had Jeff Idelson was there, Larry Bear, Bill White, the former Giant, and then most people know him. He's the commissioner also, or the president of the National League, I'm sorry. Most people know him as a Yankee announcer. He was there. And then they dedicated a statue of him in his Monte Irvin Park, and I was fortunate enough to be asked to speak. And that was a lovely thing. It's a statue that, you know, if it was really much bigger, it would look identical to the ones they have at what is now Oracle Park in San Francisco for Mays, McCovey, Cepeda, Marichal, and Gaylord Perry.
Yeah, I'm taking a look at the statue right now. It is, I've certainly passed it before on my journeys around Jersey. And interestingly enough also, to go back to what you were saying about the Negro Leagues, he played for the Newark Eagles mostly in the Negro Leagues. And obviously it's a tough thing to keep track of. It's a tough thing to keep track of the stats with this, but, you know, you see 351. He hit 400 in 1 year in 1941, according to this, when he was age 22. Again, it's hard to know exactly, you know, what stats aren't here, but you see that he was a force at the plate for sure.
I of course didn't see him. I'm too young. I'm 58. It's old now. But my dad always spoke about how graceful a player he was, and he was one of his favorites for sure.
And Jersey City, I'm in Hoboken currently, and Jersey City housed the AAA Giants for many years. And in 1949, he had 373 with a 519 on base percentage, Gary. That is just that is just something that
every
you,
other
you,
time
you
he's
see.
On base. That's
every
wonderful.
Other batter, yeah. That's crazy. It's absolutely insane. And I mean, of course, he only had 266 plate appearances for the Jersey City Giants in 1949. But, you know, whatever at bats he was able to get, he obviously made the most of it.
It's great. You know, when I spoke, I had the stats in front of me like you're looking now. And I spoke about what a wonderful player he was. But judging by all the people who attended his memorial and statue, they really just thought he was an incredible human being, like one of the nicest people. And, you know, based on what I've seen and heard, I can't disagree with that. Nobody ever said a bad word about
him. Right, exactly. And when typing in Monte Irvin statue, you are one of the first photos to pop up here. And you're standing next to Mario
Alioto.
Is that how you pronounce
right.
it? Alioto.
Alioto, yeah. He's one of the Giant executives in San Francisco.
Oh, very, very nice. Yeah, it's a great, nice suit. You're wearing a Giant tie, too.
That was one of my better-looking days.
You're always sharp, Gary. I've got to go. I'm going to go take a photo soon, as soon as I possibly can.
It's really nice. It's unfortunate, you know. They should really. I you know, they're more San Francisco based out there because it's San Francisco, but. That's a stunning statue, and it would look good out in San Francisco, a replica of it. Let me tell you.
It would. It would be a good idea to put it somewhere. Obviously, they have a lot of statues, and you know, they forgot a bullpen. One of the reasons why it is, in the classic sense, it's on the side of the foul territory. But I do believe
now
that it would behoove
there's
them.
Talk now, yeah, there's talk now of maybe changing the dimensions of the park out there and taking away the bullpens. But, you know, the Giants don't have hitting right now, so I wouldn't be so fast to make any changes, but that's just me.
So, you know, we obviously are a historical podcast, but we do like to talk about the legacy. So what is going on with the San Francisco Giants right now?
I actually think their new GM is going to do a very good job. He, of course, came from the Dodgers. They have a lot of older players with high salaries that are going to be hard to move. And as a Giant fan, it's very hard to watch. That being said, I want these guys to do well in the hopes that we could trade them. These three World Series wins have changed my whole outlook on baseball. I used to really want guys on the team, and now it's like, you know, thank you, and you know, thanks for helping us win, and you know, if need be, goodbye. I waited 41 years for a world championship. Never thought I'd see one. Lucky enough, I've seen three from 2010, 12, and 14. So I think this guy is going to sort out what's there now. Highly paid players who are not really producing, try to trade them, and build up the farm teams. And I actually think if you're patient enough, I think it'll pay off.
So, speaking of which, I mean, it's crazy that they won so many within a span of basically six seasons, I believe, and or five.
Exactly,
seasons,
exactly. Three and five years.
Right, 3 and 5 years, and now it's been 5 years since the last World Championship. So, are you still spoiled from it?
I take the losing a lot easier. That does not mean I've lost one iota of my fandom. It's just, you know, the last game I went to, not the last game, the last really good game I went to was actually the Mets-Giants playoff game at Citi Field when Syndergaard pitched against Bumgarner. The Giants were nice enough to send me tickets, which Stacy Slaughter, thank you, to this day. They sent me tickets, and that was the most riveting baseball game I ever went to. I mean, it was 0-0, you know, and then you know, Gillespie hit a home run, and then when he hit the home run, there was deafening silence. That was a wonderful game, and then they fell apart against the Cubs, and since then, no good. You know, when the Giants were winning, they had incredible pitching. They really did. Now they have their pitching is okay. I think it's actually getting a little better. But they have not scored a run in the first inning in any game this year. You're always behind.
Wow.
It's very hard to play catch-up baseball when you don't have the ability to hit a home run. The Giants don't have any power hitters. Every team, all you hear is launch angle and distance. And I don't give a rat's you know what about any of that stuff. I know what a good ball player is. All I care about is the ball going over the fence. I don't really care how far or how fast. That's just me. And, you know, I know this term old school. Maybe that defines me. But I think I know what a good baseball player is. And I think I know a player who's, you know, on the way out or you know, getting worse. The stats are wonderful, but they're also, some of them to me are very meaningless.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the whole launch angle thing either. I mean, I go pretty old school for a relatively at this point. I'm gaining up in years, as we all are at every moment of the day. but
I trade you.
I tend to get a little bit get off my lawn about some of these things that they're trying to implement. And I also think, like, if we're about to go on a rant about it, I think some of these, like, you look at what Rob Manfred's trying to do to save time, it's saving the most minuscule of time, while all the replays and the way that they go about doing the replays adds 5 minutes to the game every single night because these guys take forever. What is so wrong with putting a fifth umpire up there? And what, why do we have to see this archaic box? I like to call it the dude's phone that the guy with the headphones comes out with. If anybody out there has ever seen the Big Lebowski, the dude is carrying around an early cell phone that has that's giant on his shoulder, and that's basically what these guys go out with. And you could have a fifth umpire just go, you got here, take a look at it on an iPad. What is so wrong with looking at it on an iPad?
I totally agree. You pay the extra guy. He's at the park already. The umps don't even have to call up to him. He calls down to them. He's watching the game. I don't get it.
Exactly.
While you're on your seconds. And while you're on your rampage, if any player now retires and goes directly into the booth, when is this going to stop? I mean, it's enough. I thought people go to college to learn how to be announcers. They take any guy now who retires, and he goes right to the booth. It's like they have a second chance where people like you and I, once we're done with our career, we are done. Just me talking.
I'll tell you somebody who I think could segue directly into the booth, and I don't know whether he wants to do this, but I think Curtis Granderson would be a great color commentary guy to just segue on in when he's done. And
You're probably right about him. The other day I'm watching the Giants are being no-hit by Colorado, okay? And Eric Burns is on MLB looking at the TV telling us that if you're a Giant fan, you're rooting for him to throw a no-hitter. No, I'm not, because then I got to hear the news all day about how bad the Giants are. I don't want to hear that. And then he tells me after 12 innings, he's bored and he's in the entertainment business, and each team should have the bases loaded with no outs after the 12th inning. What is that? This is a guy I want to listen to.
That is
click.
I don't want to hear that. What kind of baseball is that when you're putting somebody on second to speed up the game?
It's video baseball.
That is not the way.
Not the way of the game to play. That's all.
And
so
I'm looking at it. He's not that. Yeah, go ahead.
That stuff like that makes me it makes me not like the game. And I love the game, and I want to continue loving the game. But when guys like him start talking, I got to change the channel. And that's my prerogative.
What was the name
of
the person you're talking about?
Eric Burns.
Yeah.
He'd be an outfielder, a tough outfielder who would, run through a wall. But
I hear you on that. I'm trying to think. And speaking of which, I can completely relate to you, considering that the Giants threw a no-hitter within the last 3 to 5 years. I forget whether – was that 2015? It was 2016 or 2015?
I think it was Lincecum threw the last one. And that's when Lincecum was –
It was some random name.
Oh, that's right. The guy against the Mets. I apologize. It was against the Mets.
Okay.
Exactly.
Giants,
not on the Giants anymore.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying, like, as a Mets fan.
You're right. I forgot his name. That's
Chris
Heston. That's correct. I don't think he's
that was
on any. In the minors somewhere, maybe. The last time I heard, he was on Seattle.
Oh, it's the Dallas Braden effect.
Was his on Mother's Day, right? Dallas Braden.
Dallas Braden's was on Mother's Day for the and
A's.
With his grandma in attendance. I believe if I remember correctly, he was motherless, and
I didn't know that.
It was a big deal. He was raised by his grandmother, and I will briefly, obviously, we're only going across the bay right now talking about it, but I believe that's one of the reasons why it was quite the fitting way for, Peggy Lindsay, who raised him after his mother died of cancer when he was in high school. On
Very
Mother's
nice.
Day.
The reason I
mean,
remember
like,
is because all those years, all you ever heard was perfect game, Jim Bunning against the Mets on Father's Day. So this was the sister now with Mother's Day. So that's why I remember when Dallas Braden threw the no-hitter.
And to tie it back around to the mystique of baseball, and you know, I'm going to tangent a little bit, but this is one of the things that Rob Manfred needs to remember, is that you got to keep the fans you already have to make new fans. If what you're trying to do here is get with the, you know, the youth doesn't like baseball or whatever, and that the majority of the fans are white and above 50, you have to remember that they still – same thing with Star Wars. I told you I was going to tangent a little bit. You have to remember that they're the ones who have built you up.
That's
and
correct.
You can't lose them. Otherwise, you don't have any fans at all. And going to why I believe in the mystique of baseball and why I believe in kind of the outside world, the world that we cannot see, with the only Mets no-hitter in history, Johan Santana, one of my favorite Mets of all time, if not my all-time favorite Met, just because of the memory he gave me and the heart that he put into the team. Gary Carter had died that year, and the final score was 8-0. And what fan runs out onto the ball field but somebody in a Gary Carter jersey? And all of a sudden, there's Gary Carter somewhat, even though he gets thrown onto the floor by the security. There's Gary Carter celebrating with an 8-0 victory. And I think they even had eight hits, if I am not mistaken, as I look up.
And that, of course, was his jersey number.
Right, exactly. And that's why it's hard for me. And thank you, because I hadn't mentioned it. I did need to – that was a detail that was missing for our fans out there. And it's clearly – there's just something about it. If you want to wrap up with what you think about how it keeps you connected to the spirits, if you believe in that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Baseball, you know, everything I learned from baseball was from my father. And, you know, his love of the game got me into it. I mean, he would, every morning I'd get up and, hey, did the Giants win? I was, you know, eight years old. And he would always say that's where the polo grounds were. And I didn't know, nor did I really care. And then as I got older, I cared. I remember our first game together.
Exactly.
We saw the Giants were playing the Mets. Gary Gentry throws 10 innings of shutout baseball. Juan Marichal, 13 innings. Bottom of the 14th inning, Tommy Agee's up. My father would not take me to the bathroom, so my older brother had to take me. And while we're in the stall, we hear the roar, and he grabs my arm. We run out. Tommy Agee's running around third. Home run, Giants lose 1-0. That was my first game, 1969.
And what a year that was for the Mets. And to wrap up what we're talking about, they did have eight hits in that ball game. So you had eight runs, eight hits, and Gary Carter in a number eight jersey was celebrating on the field the year he passed. I just can't help but think that he willed the Mets to their first no-hitter and willed Johan Santana, who had gone through so much personally when it comes to injuries, the best pitched, arguably the best pitched game of his career, because he did have some walks in that game, and he might have been sharper in some other games, but he collected the first Mets no hitter of all time. Gary, we're coming to the end of the show, and some of you listening live are going to lose us in about 15 seconds, but we will. we will carry over for a hot second into the archive version. And so thank you guys for listening to whoever's listening live. I don't believe it will work out afterwards. But Gary, for the last word, which is what I always like to have with these podcasts, the last word, if there's anything specifically that you wanted to touch on that we haven't yet regarding Giants and their history.
Absolutely. But I know what a big Met fan you are, Sam. My favorite, most underrated Met of all time, Jerry Kuzman. Thought he was a fabulous pitcher.
Yeah.
I really did. He was great. And I loved watching him pitch. And I remember one year when they were really bad, I think he was like 3-15, and his ERA was like maybe 3. You know, now if your ERA is under 4.50, you're considered good. I mean, the game really has changed. What I wanted to add was I am going up to Cooperstown the end of May to represent our group. I've been asked to speak by the Cooperstown Symposium on Baseball, and I sent in an abstract that was accepted regarding how to keep a franchise alive, a team alive that, is actually no longer playing baseball. And I am very much looking forward to it. It's something that I love, and I love running this organization. It's a lot of work. But I really enjoy it, and I enjoy – that's how I met you. You know, you're a great guy, and anything
yeah.
I could do to help you get where you got to go, I will do that.
Thank you, Gary. And if you could tell our listeners and myself what that date was again.
It is May 29th to May 31st. I am still awaiting the exact day when I am speaking. I am a teacher, so I can't really – go up there for the 3 days. Hopefully it's going to be May 30th and I'll come back May 31st, at nighttime. That's my goal if they can swing that for me. But it really is an honor.
I'm marking it down into my calendars. Yeah, I'm going to mark it into my calendar right now, excuse me. Just to make sure that if I am able to go, I would.
I spoke there once before. I'm a social studies teacher, and I write baseball trials, mock trials, and I have done 6 on baseball. So 3 years ago, I submitted that abstract. They accepted me. And one thing, Sam, that I know you would love, the Thursday nights that they're there, when the hall closes, they have dinner for you in the plaque room where all the plaques are. And it's a great feeling. You know, you're there alone with the other people eating, and you're sitting in, hallowed ground, so to speak.
And, I think a good amount of our listeners have either been there or already have a set up to go. But I just have to say, for anybody listening out there who's as into baseball history as Gary and I am, you've got to go, not just because of the museum, but the town is just spectacular. I'm lucky enough that my mother has a house somewhere upstate, and it's only about 2 hours through the back roads. And so
right.
I've been able to travel from the back roads all the way to Cooperstown, which is just such a magnificent drive, too. New York State is so beautiful. And
it is
I advise anybody who can make it here, go up there.
Sam, one traffic light in town, right?
One traffic light in town, and I think the Cooperstown Diner, it is just to die for, just one of those classic coffee shops. Everybody's got to get a chance to go. And also, it must be really buzzing when you go in the middle of the summer. There must be so many people, but there's something about the quietness when you go on a random
Absolutely.
Day in December, Gary.
That's what,
when I'm going
in May, it's, after that week, it's probably, Memorial Day, it's right after Memorial Day, it's going to start getting crowded. I am also going up with some friends for the induction weekend in July, and it's going to be, Mariano Rivera is getting put in, so there's going to be a lot of people making the trek up, and I'm sure where your relatives live, you probably go through Roscoe and, probably it's a great ride. It really is.
And let me just also finish bringing it back to the Dodgers. Hopefully next year we're going to be celebrating Gil Hodges being put into the Hall of Fame on July of 2020.
Let me tell you something.
I can't reiterate enough. Yes.
One of my trials was about Hodges getting in. I wrote two baseball trials regarding the Brooklyn Dodgers. One was Gil Hodges. It was a debate about whether he should get in and not get in. The judges ruled that he should get in. The other was the borough of Brooklyn was actually suing the Dodgers for leaving Brooklyn. So those two I wrote. I wrote one about Josh Prager's book, Echoing Green, about the Marichal Roseboro. There's another Dodger incident with the bat. 1919, we revisited the Black Sox scandal. And the sixth one I did was about Horace Stoneham getting into the Hall of Fame. You know, everybody thought he was this drunk guy, but he actually did as much for baseball, if not more, than Walter O'Malley did. And O'Malley is in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
and O'Malley
is not right.
Right, and O'Malley is much more vilified than Stoneham. Most Giant fans accepted the fact that the stadium was in a bad area and the stadium was going bad.
Right,
but Horace Stoneham set up baseball in Arizona, went to California, was instrumental in getting Latinos into the game, Asians into the game, as well as blacks into the game. So the stuff that said bad about him, it can be very much counteracted with a lot of the things he did well. I think a lot of people more or less look at how he drank a lot.
Yeah, you know, everybody likes to hone in on these one-dimensional elements of people. That is something that I mean, you get Carl Erskine on here, and he has nothing but glowing things to say about Walter O'Malley and the way Walter O'Malley treated his son with the Down syndrome condition. So, you know,
right.
you got to get the full picture. The bottom line is that's one of the reasons why when developing this piece, you know, on my better days when I'm doing it, I'm trying to not necessarily peg Walter O'Malley directly as the villain.
Right.
Because I think it still sounds like for everybody that Robert Moses can really be that over the overarching campaign of the entire series.
Of course. Well, the funny thing is that where the Barclays Center is where O'Malley wanted the stadium, and Moses wouldn't allow it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So.
That's right. Although there is some weird middle room, you know, in terms of that. Considering that Walter O'Malley could have figured out a way, like Charlie Ebbets did with Ebbets Field, to buy the land from the proprietors who owned it, Robert Moses just didn't want to give it away as eminent domain. The entire, I'm not a businessman. And who's to say that everything regarding business is evil, quote unquote? You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
So.
Yep.
There's a lot of places to look, and there's a lot of different elements to judge, like you said with these judgment calls that your students make. It's very interesting to take a look, and it's one of the reasons why I want to make this series is to explore it on a dramatic level as best as possible.
Absolutely, you're doing a great job. Listen, if you have a need,
thank you, Gary, and I appreciate.
my ex-principal's husband, huge Brooklyn Dodger fan. He's been on shows talking and stuff. If you have a need to speak to another guy, keep that in mind.
Sure, let's connect about that after the podcast. And you know, as always, Gary, I appreciate you joining us. I'm glad to get the wheel rolling for the 2019 campaign with you. You know, it's been a while since I was on the air, so I appreciate you joining me today. Thank you.
Sam, anytime, in any place. All right, man, you be well.
You as well, and thank you all to listening today, and have a wonderful, wonderful day. Take care. Thanks for joining the Bedford Sullivan podcast.